Every living thing, human, animal and vegetable has a certain amount of electromagnetic forces planted within them, but where the difficulty arises with so many is that they do not know the nature of these forces or have no realization whatever of how to draw upon them in themselves. One half the failures in your world in business and otherwise is due to non-comprehension of these same forces. I have in my close study of these deep and underlying laws of life and might come into such close contact with them as to be able to define almost instantly on meeting a spirit or mortal, the nature of his forces, whether more magnetic or electric, or vice versa. I love to seek it out in growing things, budding vegetation, and oftentimes when I make a visit to Earth I impart secretly to some growing plant an extra supply of these forces, and then we are amused to see the mortals gape in wonder at the so-called marvelous growth of that particular plant. I have performed the same act with flowers which were puny and trifling in growth, because their keeper did not know how to place them conveniently in order that they might reap the full benefit of these forces from the very life of nature herself. And coming upon them in this plight, I would instantly generate out of the laws and forces at my command what was needed for their precious health, and lo, in but a few days of earthly time I would again visit my charges and see their keeper bending over them in rapture's amazement. I have helped hundreds and hundreds of spirits to communicate by the practice of these same laws. I am very happy in my labors and am learning more and more as I travel on up through eternity. I am a student of Professor Faraday, with loving remembrance. I dedicate this little writing to my father and mother, Edward and Lizzie Butler, of Memphis, Mo. Mental mediumship, ITS uses and abuses, John C. Bundy. This is such a broad and a likewise delicate subject that I approach it most cautiously and earnestly. In the first place I will ask you a question and answer it, so that you will see what I mean as I write further. What is first necessary, in any spiritual manifestation, to give proof of such, to an open, candid and unprejudiced mind? I would say truthfully that the first requisite would be for the spirit's manifesting, to give some certain clue if only small to his or her identity. There was never any person living but what possessed some one characteristic or another, that would identify him or her anywhere. Now there is no phase of mediumship whatever, but such as is left open to the spirit to give, thus something that will plainly show for itself, one identity or another. You say, well, sometimes a spirit entrances a medium and cannot in so doing, make itself strong enough, or material enough to give proof to the doubting mind. My friends, cease to blame the spirits so much for their want of strength and natural qualities, as you are preaching every day, that we take the same traits of character with us to the spirit world as we have in your earth plane. Then if a spirit thus has his being and intelligence, let me tell you plainly, that he still retains them when trying to manifest through a medium. Then the fault must rest largely with a medium, we mean medium so-called or instrument, misdirected, or undeveloped. Friends of earth, a misguided mediumistic person, who does not know the first principle of intelligent spirit communication, does emphatically just as much harm in posing before a credulous public, as an arrant fraud. Now, I will explain to you just what I wish to express. For instance, you, my reader, wished after hearing a great deal, to investigate spiritualism, and naturally you would enter into the first door that opened in that direction. Your mind is clear and honest, untouched by bigotry or prejudice, and you just simply want to know if there is another life after death. In order for you to know that to a surety, you would have to come into contact with some tangible proof in the way of identified evidence. If you went to hear voices in the trumpet, you would most naturally expect them to say something that you could understand and realize as a truth. If you go to a materialization, you are most certainly desirous of seeing some face that you could recognize before and have had personal proof positive that such seance bears evidence of another life. And where is the person who will enter a materializing seance and depart satisfied, unless he has received evidence? There is no such person living. And many persons visiting physical manifestations, test each happening to the very utmost. Why? Because they can, the physical manifestations will bear the most crucial investigation. How have all the thinking people been convinced of the actual existence of another life? By coming in contact personally with some spirit from that beautiful country, through the materializing or trumpet seance, or by some tangible circumstance in the performance of the mental phases. Now, my friends, we as teachers and leaders in the spirit world, were in favor of all the known phases of mediumship, and the study and practice thereof, but the burden of our message to you is exactly this: we must have intelligent instruments and an intelligent output of our assiduous labors. If we work and labor for hundreds and thousands of years to unfold before the world all the known phases of mediumship through instruments who are of an organism capable and in every way apartment to give out in an intellectual and perfectly proper manner the messages to your world that we give them, and that thereby the world of listeners are entranced and charmed with the glorious truth and beauty of this, the other life, then we have certainly done our labor of love well indeed, and have attained an end by so doing that will cause the deep thinkers of your earth to pause and find the doctrines of spiritualism to be the eternal truth of the heavens. And with such influence of only the best instruments for us to do our work through, we could raise our blessed spiritualism up to the pinnacle heights of righteousness and true purpose before the people of earth. Yes, and there it would rest secure through all the ages. But while we are striving for this very end, and are gaining notice as each day of earth time goes on, we come into contact with a very deplorable state of affairs on the other hand. Would-be instruments of the spirit world, seeing the grand results of the true mediums, those of the chosen few, decide to gain fame and fortune for themselves by the practice of mediumship, so-called. These pitiable charlatans give out only results that are so thin in texture that the reasonable world can readily see the decoy, and with shame and chagrin, depart from the investigation of spiritualism forever. Then there is a class of so-called mediums who think to gain favor in the world by the slaughter of grammar, by their very illiteracy itself, and have and do make a business of it, posing right in the face of intelligent people, to try and leave upon them the impression of their honesty, for they believe that the credulous will think them perfectly honest on account of their disgusting ignorance. And it is safe to say that in many instances they are right in this belief, for we often hear people say of such impostors, "Oh, they could not be anything else but honest since they are too ignorant to know how to deceive." Some of the most wily criminals of all ages could neither read or write their own names. Because a medium is ignorant, it does not hold that he is honest always, but his ignorance practically unfits him for the practice publicly of his gift. People who have been more fortunate and who have received what the environments of every culture and refinement could give them, are sick with disgust at the futile attempts of some of the so-called mediums of your world. We know full well that because an ignorant person possesses mediumship, it is no reason that he should divorce it, but let him have the common sense and good judgment to keep within the boundaries of his own environment, and never try to force his incoherent teachings on the public. We also realize that when the heart is hungry for relief from woe, when the soul is starved to really know where the loved ones have gone, that if they happen to receive that knowledge from the lips of ignorance, it is just as clear, and likewise just as valuable as if it came from cultured mediums. But it is a little inconsistent to be holding communication with a spirit who upon earth made use of the best possible English and who bore the stamp of every culture, whom you suddenly find in speaking through some trance medium to be utterly devoid of his early phraseologies, and you are really astonished to find none of the earmarks that he formerly bore. It is a little shaking to the faith of the early investigator, to say the least. Then there are those in a like circumstance, that would explain away the incident in this manner, that possibly the spirit was weak and could not manifest without taking on a portion of the medium's personality. Now, it makes no difference how weak a spirit may be if he be able to speak at all. He must certainly and most truly do so in a characteristic manner, for being in a state of weakness would never occasion him to disguise his speech of such a manner. On the other hand, if spirits coming through a presenting or trance medium must take on that medium's condition in order to manifest, then such an instrument must be declared unable for practice, since his unfoldment is in such a state of confusion that the sitter cannot divine whether he be talking with the medium or the spirit. We understand clearly, how those comprehending the laws underlying the practice of mediumship would readily make allowance for such so-called minor occurrences, and all would pass smoothly and be right. But those who already know do not have to be convinced, as they are firm in the conviction and need no further proof. But what, my earthly friends, are we to do with the ones who do not know, the hearts that are hungry, and do not know the path wherein their food lies richest, wandering in darkness, and cannot find the way to their father's house? Do you think this practice of incoherence, this confusion between excuses for this and for that, will really help them to set their feet within the righteous way? We know that there are those in your world who would never grasp a truth even if it were held out to their very hand and given freely for the asking, but to these we do not refer when we remind your thinkers of the thousands and thousands of open candid minds who are asking for the bread of spiritual truth each day, and when multiplied numbers of them have to turn away each day with the same disappointing sentiment on their lips. If that be spiritualism, let me have no more of it. The reason we are laboring so assiduously to gift this glorious truth to the world is visibly clear: to add power and beauty to the eternal ranks of heaven, so that many more each year may become enlightened before they cross the borderland, and so raise and uplift our glorious cause on earth that men will pause and take notice of it. If we could do this, we could make real spiritualism the savior of the world, and you, the people of earth, can cause this wondrous reformation by making it only possible for mediums to practice who are tried and not found wanting. If our glorious truth is only practical for those who already know its value and will not stand the investigation of fair and unbiased minds who do not know, but who are seeking to learn, then our years on hundreds of years of labor over here are almost an abject failure. Arise and reform this state of affairs, you who are in the position to do so. You can easily get rid of incompetent mediums by treating them with polite indifference. When people cease to know such mediums, then will arise the great and much needed reform. We would like to see conditions made so that all the so-called sensitives that are constantly springing up in your glorious land might be placed under due proof of their claims, before they are allowed to give their work to the public. We do not mean by this that they should continually be tested, and by people who are incompetent judges, but that persons who were chosen by the people and who have made an assiduous study of all the laws governing spirit manifestation should be the judges of the competency of new mediums just entering the public as leaders and teachers of the world at large. This state of things we know would be hard to accomplish, but the old and true saying holds good here the same as in other things: there is no excellence without great labor. How did the world of thinkers countenance the now old mediums when first they embarked on the sea of public practice? Did they sit with folded hands and likewise placid thought, and take for granted all that these their new mediums told them, or did they question their manifestations at all? They did not know, and not knowing, they most certainly placed them under the most cruel and servile test conditions, and God pity those who were built of the true stuff and came out with spotless garments and clean hearts and are living and practicing in your world today. We do not, for one moment, ask that the instruments of today be treated as these of old were treated, but we do plead with earnest thinkers to prove each and all mediums alike before advocating them. Why do you ask? Just this: each medium before the public should stand on his own merits entirely, and not be allowed to rest on the results that others have labored for and won, not live easily on the reputation that others may have carved out by long years of suffering and privation, but to make for themselves a character in their work. This is a special character in their work. How it can be done, step by step, and inch by inch, until they can really say that they are entitled to a place in the mediumistic world. And you of the earth plane are largely to blame for this condition of error in first being convinced of some medium who has traveled through fire to gain the place that he holds, then thereby gaining the certain knowledge of spirit return, turn instantly to investigate some other one who has never known what a test condition was, and swallow all that he gives unquestioned and unmoved. We do not write this to cause a questioning doubt to arise in any mind, but we do mean that each medium should be shown like treatment, and then each medium's work would show for itself whether it be worthy or unworthy. Each instrument should be weighed in the balance if one is weighed there. The world should show no partiality in this matter whatever. In so doing, you could easily rid the world of incompetent mediums. Incompetency in private use we speak not of, nor of mediums rather who confine their practice for the benefit of their own families, but when they introduce their work upon the public at large, it must necessarily be weighed before it is accepted as a settled science. There is nothing in your world today that has one half the value of mediumship in it. There is nothing existing there that gives the comfort to an aching and troubled heart, as does the communication of spirits through the various phases of mediumship. But what we are striving to arrive at is the intelligent and just dispensation, when all instruments of spirits shall find their true level, and reach not one jot above or below that level. This will then be the true visitation, and all shall come into righteous possession of their own. A true and worthy medium is as a precious gift God given to the world, and is even more in worth than all the bright gold and jewels thereof, and to us is an object of untold value and a joy forever. For within their powers lies the salvation of the world, and deep within the laws that in them dwell, lie locked all the soothing of the sorrowing hearts and rests secure the balm that will in time be poured by them over the troubled waters of all the griefs and losses of those of your earth. Within them lies the solution of all wrongs and errors that now exist with you, dear earthly friends, but their mediumship must be right in every way before these precious results can be obtained in any way whatever. Why, clear ones, mediums of quality are like beacon lights that shed their welcome rays out over a stormy sea, and guide the straying ships and the lost crew safely within the security of the harbor. For what is more stormy than the troubled sea of life? You now that have travelled o'er its billows and were oftentimes almost lashed to sure death under the angry waves, but that some welcome ray from the near lighthouse of the keeper of the signal light shot athwart the darkness and at last guided you safely home. You that have ridden over the same sea of trouble can readily read between the lines and see that medium that saved you through the help of the spirit friends and brought you within the light and comfort of your father's house. We say with loud acclaim, glory be given in the fullest to the mediums who have served us honestly and trustworthily and who have made sacrifice after sacrifice, for the development we offered them. Thank God, they have won. Love, Mary N. N. Evans. Love is the factor which permeates and vibrates through each thing that has life, being the element in man, and likewise in every other being that refines and creates a taste for the better and the spiritual things. Love is the actual motive power of the universe, and this is why God is love. When we express this thought, we do not mean, or wish to convey the idea that real love is simply an attachment that one being might feel for another, but that love is the real searchlight that seeks and understands all hearts, that bears and forbears, that is all suffering and ever kind, that is willing and that lays a gentle hand upon an enemy as well as a friend, that sees and knows and suffers all things. Love is as unchangeable as God, the love element in man when it is strong and real, and clothed with righteousness, will surely shut out all of his grosser elements. Nothing can live which is divested of this wonderful power. And wherever you see it, you see God. The Orthodox ministry sometimes tell you that someone has gotten away from God, and that by preaching and appealing very much to God, that they may be able to bring him back. Dear ones of earth, this is an impossibility, as one who loses the God part of himself must lose his own soul, it must therefore, die and become as the withered leaf that whirls away to nothingness in the autumn winds. Now you who have come into the blessed knowledge of spirit return, know that it is impossible for souls to be destroyed, and therefore, you will realize how very absurd it is to believe that anyone ever got away from God. For as long as he has existence, this is impossible, and you are convinced that the soul lives forever. So you see how easily that we are one with God all of us, and we cannot get away from him if we try ever so hard. Then you have heard of people who said there was no God, or at least if there was, they did not know him. Why, if they knew they were living, they knew God most assuredly. For God is life. These minds only reason of the infinite from a purely literal standpoint. But when we saw the skies and view the starry dome of heaven and breathe the divine air of spirit, we know that we cannot carry literal reasoning everywhere with us, for the law of attraction binds it to material things. Gray-bearded science has shaken its head at us before now, and we expect that it will again, even at the reading of this article, but all it had in the world claiming to be reality, would never make it unreal. We of this band, are wending our way very closely through eternity, and have at times come very near to the higher gradations in the topmost heights of the seventh heaven or sphere, and we have studied carefully all that has come under our observation in our journeyings and progression. A mother that is all a mother, who sits at eventide, when the lights are low, and croons with tender voice the sleepy song to the slumbering infant in her arms, who holds it close in the sweet grasp of devotion and fondly dreams the future welfare of her child, this is love, and if you were very near, you could look with me and see God there. The mother who loves most the wayward boy, who grieves most for his welfare, who always has an excuse for his shortcomings, is a picture of self-sacrifice, is a model of the gentle but strong tenderness of a pure heart's love for its offspring. Love is as innate in everything that has life as the very life principle itself. We watch nature in all its varying forms of beauty and see in all her wonders the love principle permeating and radiating in each tiny tree twig, in upspringing flowers, mountains, rivers and the mighty cataracts. What's the great sun smiling on the rose garden, coming very near and kissing the crimson velvet of the petals jealous of the early dews, and making haste to cause them to disappear from off the tender bosom of the queen of flowers. He is mightier and more stately than his rival of the night before, the pensive, sighing, morning dew. Being conscious of his mightiness, he darts athwart the sleepy morning sky, and speedily shoots his rays on the earth and her children, but loving most the fragrant rose garden. But she does not care for him as she does her other and her favorite lover, the breeze. The rain loves her so well that he sheds his bounty of life upon her. The dew softens and nourishes her. The great sun in all his majesty stoops and warms her with vivifying rays, and caresses her into such blushing beauty that other flowers bow in homage to her. But the breeze only comes and brings her dainty sweets of fragrance, only whispers dreamily of her honey heart and is continually flattering her beauty, yet she languishes when he is absent, and if he comes infrequently, her hot tears fall and wither her wonderful face. He is wanton and fickle, but she does not know it, for when he breathes the very same little tendernesses in the ears of other flowers, she vainly turns her head and dreams of the romance of his presence and the sweetness of his love-warm breath. It is as natural for the love aura to flow in the life of the animal and vegetable kingdoms as it is in the life of humanity. All nature has a language specifically for its particular kind or common understanding, and no day goes by but that the animal and vegetable kingdoms communicate just as we do, only we are not of their order and therefore cannot understand their tongue. We have, since coming to this side of life, seen and heard mortals of earth express their pride in attaining for themselves an understanding of all languages of men, airing their selfish pride of having the noted distinction of being linguists, but all this amounted really to nothing better than dribble, for in entering the spirit world they will all find that we converse in precisely the same language, and any other language but English is obliterated over here. And so you see they have lost the best part after all in not learning or trying to learn the language of all nature, so that they might communicate with the flowers, birds and trees, and dwell in the heart of earth pulsing life, and when the time comes for the great disrobing and donning the bright raiment of spirit life, they would have so gained by their understanding and life close to nature that on entering the spirit realms, they would actually be at once caught up in the realms of the blessed. Ah! That mortals could comprehend once and for all, that all life is dependent upon some other life and that this is the reason that love must exist in everything. Otherwise, what a different world you of the earth would be living in today. We are laboring, and expect to continue to labor with the world until this ideal and sublime condition is reached. The soul that forgets all wrong, that looks over all error and only realizes undeveloped good in the whole, is the soul in which love exists in large and overflowing measure. Such souls are the ones who become instruments in the hands of the spirits to enlighten and save the world. In the early springtime as we walk abroad in the fields, filled with delight at the peeping violets which are just beginning to show their faces, we know as we gaze at them that naught but love painted the tender pale purple of their petals, and that this divine power of love gives them their precious life from day to day. We witness the kingly majesty of the great seagull as he soars aloft seemingly into the very blue vaults of heaven and speeds over all his vast domain like a prince of strength and power. Ah! With him also goes ever that ecstasy, that all-powerful fullness of life which is love, and which is like unto God. How can you doubt, O mortals of earth, that love rules your universe, when you see each day of your life all around you the wonders of nature's own making, that utter dependence of one life on another, and from such dependence springs the divine principle, love. This same searching power shall at last penetrate the darkest corners of your world, shall at last enter all hearts with its sweet strength and set them everyone aright. Even as the sun envelops and warms your earth, giving it light and heat always, so shall this love power be known of men and respected of humanity. Think what this will mean, when money will not have to be under the lock, when mortals will cease to bear false witness against each other and joy shall reign king. The Day of Reckoning, James Howard McConnell. I stood and gazed at my corpse under its winding sheet as it lay there so cold, so stark and stiff. For I had died, but I could not get away from myself, from that part of me that was stretched so lifeless there. And so I gazed on in wonderment and mute appeal. Beside my bier sat the woman who for 30 years was my wife. For a long time she sat still with folded hands lying idle in her lap, almost as immovable and quiet as my cold corpse. Then she began to weep. At first softly, the tears rolling quietly down her cheeks and finally with great sobs that shook and racked her slender frame as a tree is writhed in a winter storm. After a while the door opened gently and my wife's sister came in. She paused just within the threshold, looking at my wife in wide-eyed astonishment, and then she said almost roughly to her, "Why do you grieve for him? No husband ever treated a wife worse. He was cruel and selfish, and ill-tempered, dissipated and unfaithful to you, and in all the years that you have been married he has brought you nothing but suffering and anxiety and shame and poverty. You should thank God for your deliverance and that you can at least pass the balance of your life in quietness and peace." "I know," answered my wife passionately, "and I do not weep for him. I weep for myself that is dead. I mourn for my lost youth, for my lost happiness, for all that life might have given to me and what he took from me. My dear. Oh, my dear. Oh, my very dear," murmured her sister, laying her hand compassionately on my wife's shoulder. "Do you remember what a pretty girl I was?" she said, speaking in a dull level voice of hopelessness that was sadder than her tears. "Do you remember how pretty I was? I can speak of that girl now as if she were some other person, so remote she seems from me. So long it is since I have seen her picture smiling back at me when I looked into a mirror. But oh, how pretty she was, with that beauty that is like the beauty of the dawn, or of the springtime, all tender pinks, and blues, and golds, and sunshine. She had cheeks that were like roses, and eyes the color of blue cornflowers, and hair that was like ripe wheat. Can you realize that that radiant creature could ever have been I? Yes, it was. After I married, people said how soon I faded, and they wondered at it. They could not know that it was the brine of bitter tears that washed the color from my eyes, nor the long nights, when I watched and waited for the drag of a drunken footstep coming up the street, that faded the roses from my cheeks as if an untimely frost had fallen on a June garden. In those first 3 years after I was married, I laid the costly offering of my beauty on the altar of an unhappy marriage. Day by day I saw myself grow old and ugly before my time, and when a woman does that she has served her purgatory here on earth. Hush, hush, breathed the sister, her own eyes full of tears. I weep, went on my wife, drearily, for the brave, high-spirited girl, as frank as the day, that I was that, he slayed. I, who had never known what it was to be afraid, grew to be a trembling coward, living always in the shadow of a brutality with which I was too delicate of mind and body to cope. He called himself a gentleman and he never struck my body with his hand, but he beat my soul black and blue with jeers and jibes that cut me to the quick, and I came to always walk cringingly for fear of provoking him to some outburst of temper. For myself I could have stood his harsh words and bitter criticism. In time I came not to even especially mind them, for weak and gross spiritually callous, but when he saw this and that he could no longer hurt me by his taunts, he learned a new trick, and tortured me through those I loved. My own misery I could endure without wincing, but when he made those who loved me suffer through their love for me, he brought me at last to his feet, ready to lie, to double deal, to do anything that would save them.